IRIB English Radio. Our website is parsetoday.com.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. La ilaha illallah. La ilaha illallah.
Now we invite you to listen to Brother Khalil Jaafar.
These are the days and nights, even though we have a busy schedule, we have to go to work in the morning, we children have school as well and so on. But these are the days and nights to bring our children to the mosque and to get them involved in activities related to Imam Hussein as much as possible. There is a lot of times where people will be critical of the things that are done in the name of Imam Hussein as quote-unquote rituals. You know, and you will hear these criticisms of, you know, what's the purpose of only wearing black clothes and just crying and just doing, you know, Shabi and Alam and Tabut and just doing Matam when we don't understand the message of Imam Hussein, and, you know, the month comes and goes and we have not taken anything from it, and just eating and drinking and Niyaz and Sabil, and, you know, what's the point? We should understand the message and we should understand the philosophy and why Imam Hussein gave his life. I don't disagree with the importance of the philosophy and the message of Imam Hussein. But at the same time, I don't agree as well any attempt to downplay what we might call as rituals. Why? Because these, what we call rituals, they have a deep impact on our psyche. They leave something within our essence and our being that shape us and make us who we are. And when we teach our children from the young age, this can actually save their lives. Your child might be a very young child today, but one day he grows up and becomes a teenager. We are always concerned as parents that our children might fall into wrong company, that they might go astray, that they might stop praying and fasting, that they might get attracted to a different tradition, or get into all kinds of trouble. And we are worried, you know, when that happens, how will we be able to rescue them? So we are always trying to protect them. One of the ways in which you can protect your children is to make them Husseini constantly. You will find that at the most difficult times in their lives, even as adults, it is this aza of Hussein that will save them and bring them back. I can assure you. Why do I say this? You see, the Quran in its place, but a person's relationship with the Quran is not a human-to-human relationship. At the end of the day, the Quran does not represent itself as a person, even though it has its own reality. It is a book. So one might know a lot about the Quran, but at some point they might put it aside and still do something wrong. But if someone has a personal relationship and love for Imam al-Hussein, then that bond remains with him all his life. And it indoctrinates him in ways you cannot understand. It will stop your child, even when he is at the last moments on the brink of hellfire. It will pull him back when the days of Aza come. He will remember, regardless of what it is, when the month of Muharram comes, I have to go cry for Hussein. His heart will beat, Ya Hussein, Ya Hussein. It will not allow him otherwise.
IRIB English Radio.
Our website is parsetoday.com.
Welcome back to your listeners. In continuation to our subject, which in the current program is this question about what is mura'at, what is considerateness, and of course, what is the relationship between considerateness, mura'at, and our ubudiyyah. So in the previous segment, we talked about how mura'at, considerateness, is to be considerate with our soul, to be mindful of our soul, to pay attention to the actual needs of our soul, and in reality, to not overburden it more than it can handle. Because what happens is sometimes you can break the soul, or you can, you know, make things even worse by overburdening yourself to an extent which is not, you know, doable. For we give a very interesting example of the infant and trying to feed an infant a big juicy steak of beef or lamb. Of course, the child, the infant, the six-month-old, is not suitable to be able to eat something like that. As the child grows, their strength grows, their capability grows, their potential grows, then of course, by the time they are strong enough and they are capable of being able to handle it, they can have that steak. And matter of fact, at that point in time, it is quite delicious. And in the same way, when it comes to the soul and these different activities that we do, these different spiritual activities, these different forms of ubudiya, whether they are the salah, the prayers, the recommended prayers, you know, which is known as the namaz, or the recitation of du'as and supplications, the recitation of the Qur'an, these kind of things, you know, they have to be done slowly but steadily. And slowly but steadily, they should be increased over a span of time. Now, this is the connection between being considerate and ubudiya. If we are not considerate to the soul, if we are not kind, if we're not, you know, paying attention to the needs at hand of the soul when it comes to ubudiya, then in reality, and most probably, we are going to hurt the goal, which is the sincere and pure ubudiya, the servitude and the worship and the obedience to Allah. Of course, the soul and an individual can only handle so much. If there's put a lot of pressure upon it, that pressure will eventually build and one will explode. And that explosion is, in many cases, a running away from ubudiya. It is running away from the servitude and the obedience and the worship to Allah. And so this is the connection between being considerate to one's soul, keeping in mind the capacities, the potential, the capability of the soul and our ubudiya. And so if we are considerate and we keep in mind and pay attention to the requirements of the soul, slowly but steadily increase our spiritual exercises, quote unquote, then we will be able to strengthen, enhance, and increase and level up our servitude, our obedience, our worship to Allah, our ubudiya to Allah. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Foresight. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode and another great tip, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puraza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Last year, when U.S. military forces were withdrawing from Afghanistan, thousands of foreign and Afghan citizens were also trying to get out of the country. In those days, thousands of people gathered outside the airport in the hope that they can go inside and catch a flight out. But American and NATO forces failed to control the situation, and then came a disaster. This side of the canal is where U.S. soldiers were standing, using the barbed wire not to let people pass. And this canal is where people were trying to pass and get over the ridge. The explosion also killed plus 183 persons.
I saw people, including women and children, who were running. There were people carrying the wounded with wheelbarrow. Many of the dead and wounded people were thrown into the canal. Women were running and screaming, trying to get to the hospital. We were so close, so we went there and did what we could do to help them.
It was around 6 p.m. when a suicide bomber entered a crowd of disturbed people and detonated his vest just outside the international airport of Kabul on August 26th last year. At least 183 people were killed, including 170 Afghan civilians and 13 members of the United States Army. Some say all that blood is on the hands of the Americans.
In my opinion, Americans are solely responsible for that disaster. The chaos around the airport was deliberately created by the Americans as a cover to allow them to escape. On the other hand, they were aware that such incidents are probable. So why didn't they stop the evacuation process? Why didn't they disperse the people?
Also, some citizens blame gunfire by U.S. troops after the explosion for at least some of the deaths.
We can't confirm that.
And, the Pentagon in a conference acknowledged that possibly U.S. was responsible for some deaths, but later on they said that ball bearings in the explosive vest created holes in bodies resembling bullet holes. Although this explanation sounds so fishy, it is still not known if gunfire caused some deaths or not. Just hours before the attack, U.S. diplomats in Kabul warned citizens to stay away from the city's airport. They were aware of what was about to come, but were not willing to take any steps towards preventing it. Abdullah Amirzad of Kabul.
Thousands of people rallied in the Gaza Strip to celebrate the Islamic Jihad's victory against the Israeli regime and assert the unity among Palestinian resistance groups. Earlier this month, Israeli forces assassinated a top Islamic Jihad military commander in Gaza, prompting retaliatory attacks by Palestinian resistance movements. Israeli forces killed 49 Palestinians, including 17 children, during the 3 days of fighting. The Islamic Jihad maintains that it has achieved an honorable victory in the latest confrontation with the Israeli regime. Addressing the rally through satellite transmission, Islamic Jihad Secretary General Ziad al-Nakhala praised the unity among all Palestinian resistance groups during the three-day war.
The thousands of people attending this rally today are proof that all Palestinian resistance factions are united against the Israeli enemy. We assert today during this victory and unity rally that armed resistance is the only way to liberate Palestine and regain our rights.
The popularity of Islamic Jihad movement continues to gain momentum among Palestinians due to its refusal to recognize the Israeli regime and its adherence to armed resistance against the Israeli occupation. During the 3 days of intense fighting, the Islamic Jihad rockets shattered Israel's so-called invincibility myth.
Al-Quds Brigade is sending a very strong message today to the Israeli enemy regarding the growing might of the Palestinian resistance. The enemy thought that assassinating Al-Quds Brigade commanders will weaken the Islamic Jihad, but that did not happen. Al-Quds Brigade are stronger today than ever and will continue to fight for the sake of liberating Al-Quds.
During the 3 days of fighting, the Islamic Jihad military wing fired hundreds of rockets towards the Israeli-occupied territories. Observers say that the Islamic Jihad fought a fierce battle against the Israeli regime, forcing Tel Aviv to demand a ceasefire.
The strength of the Palestinian resistance has forced the Israeli enemy to ask for a truce. The Palestinian resistance is here to protect the Palestinian people and to liberate our land. The Al-Quds brigades have managed to fire hundreds of rockets at the enemy and forced it to evacuate their towns and run for cover.
Five wars have been unleashed between Israel and Palestinian resistance groups in Gaza since 2008.
Experts believe that in any future war, the Israeli regime will be dealt a heavy blow by Palestinian resistance groups in the Gaza Strip. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
The outgoing British Prime Minister Boris Johnson has paid what could be his last visit to Ukraine as Premier. Meeting with President Volodymyr Zelensky in Ukraine's capital, Kiev, on Wednesday, Boris was hailed for his relentless support for Ukraine's war effort. He was even given a medal for his services. In the midst of ceremonies and handshakes, Johnson, however, reminded his fellow countrymen that there will be more economic hardships to come.
We also know that if we're paying in our energy bills for the evils of Vladimir Putin, the people of Ukraine are paying in their blood. And that's why we know we must stay the course.
Following the NATO-inspired conflict in Ukraine, Britain has pushed a hardline policy of arming the Ukrainians and sanctioning Russia. The result has been catastrophic on the British economy, further exacerbating a cost-of-living crisis and raising fuel prices to eye-watering levels.
Boris Johnson is completely out of touch with reality. This millionaire prime minister is telling the British people that they're going to have to continue to tighten the belts. He's presided over probably the worst cost of living crisis in living memory, which has been precipitated in large measure by Boris Johnson and his government support for a war in Ukraine, which could have quite easily been avoided. Energy bills have already doubled, or certainly gone up by well over 50%. We're being told by the energy regulator that the cap on energy bills is going to be increased still further. Already we have food banks in every town and city in this country because people can't afford to eat. Now we're going to, it looks like, have to set up in the voluntary sector kind of warm banks, I suppose, where people will be looking to go to community centres to keep warm. This is an absolute outrage.
Despite the hardships, Johnson's comments have made it perfectly clear that costs will continue to rise even after he leaves Downing Street. And British taxpayers are going to have to pay the price.
Boris may be enjoying the reputation he's built up for himself inside Ukraine, a country now left devastated by the war. However, his popularity at home may take another dive as the winter months rapidly approach and families will inevitably struggle to heat their homes and feed their loved ones this Christmas. Robert Carter, London.
Iran and Tanzania have vowed to draw a roadmap for developing bilateral relations in various dimensions. One of them is economy and trade. In this regard, Tanzania's business hub, Dar es Salaam, hosted a joint meeting of economic and trade activists from the two countries. Iran's foreign minister, Hossein Amir Abdollahian, addressed the forum, saying the development of economic relations with African countries, especially Tanzania, is one of the foreign policy priorities of Iran.
The African continent is one of the major economic diplomacy priorities of the Islamic Republic of Iran. Along this line, Tanzania, as one of the most important countries in the continent, has always had this special status in the foreign policy of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
He also expressed that Iran is prepared to help Tanzania achieve its goals of development and industrialization. He added that both sides are determined to prioritize economic diplomacy. Over 20 Iranian public and private sector companies took part in the forum to show Tehran's serious will for business cooperation with Tanzania.
Africa is a very huge market, and many
world powers come to Africa for discovering new opportunities. So I'm here with Iranian delegates to explore the east of Africa, especially Tanzania, to find out the opportunities, especially in telecommunication business, as our company involved in telecom sector.
Business cooperation between Iran and Tanzania is a bilateral opportunity for the two sides. In addition, Africa is a perfect market for Iranian goods like petrochemicals and the food industry products.
Tanzanian economic activists expressed their excitement about the expanding economic ties, saying they had been eagerly waiting for the joint business forum to kick off.
So there is a huge opportunity. Also, having this forum in Tanzania, we have been looking for it for several times. We have been asking for it because we know for all the challenges that we have been observing, this kind of forum can build up that bridge, can bridge up a gap of closing those challenges. So for us, it's a big marriage.
It is a fruitful opportunity for both countries, Iran and Tanzania, to do a cooperation in business, especially in trade, so as we can do exportation and importation of different commodities from two countries. And it is politically stable. We invite more Iranians and other investors to come invest in Tanzania. We have so much opportunity, so guys, you can maximize profit, but also make Iran better and Tanzania better.
Taking Africa's economic potential into account, the Islamic Republic opted to expand relations with African countries. Foreign Minister Amir Abdullahian's tour can be the launchpad for the Iranian government's long-term plans to expand trade with Africa.
Tehran has attached considerable significance to Africa as it looks to expand its ties with countries beyond West Asia. And Amir Abdullahian's African tour highlights the view that the world is not limited to the West. Mahdi Abbasian, Dar es Salaam.
Evidence continues to mount that France and the Eurozone are facing a long period of recession. French economic output just contracted for the first time in 18 months, with Germany's business activity plunging even deeper. The decline in output and demand has almost too many causes to list. That's 6 months into the unrest in Ukraine. Europe's energy import costs have now quadrupled. The costly conflict shows no sign of easing, as Brussels has abandoned diplomatic efforts with Moscow. The current drought across the continent appears to be the worst in the last 500 years, hurting crop yields, sparking wildfires, and increasing pessimism. That's helped push the euro to its lowest level in 20 years. The euro is now worth less than the United States dollar.
There are obviously many crises which are causing major problems for Europe, and many are linked to what's going on in Ukraine. However, we should not forget the supply chain problems which began with the coronavirus pandemic, nor the European sovereign debt crisis.
Despite the increase in gloom, last month the European Central Bank decided to raise interest rates for the first time in 11 years. That makes borrowing even more costly for businesses and individuals and could spark mass layoffs, bankruptcies, and home foreclosures. The U.S. has hiked interest rates faster than in Europe, while indicating that more rate increases will arrive soon. Since the Great Recession began, Western central banks have aligned their policies, though they do not move in an exact lockstep. The cost of living crisis is expected to significantly worsen this winter. However, many say a negative outlook for the world's most unstable macroeconomic bloc is more accurately described in years and not just seasons.
Inflation is something which could penalize the average person for 1, 2, or maybe even 3 years. So we are witnessing how the average French household is getting much, much poorer. Senior citizens are especially being hurt, and this will have major political consequences in France.
Analysts say a possible solution to Europe's energy crisis is to implement the JCPOA pact on Iran's nuclear energy program. However, both Washington and Tel Aviv continue to hinder Europe's ability to protect its own economic interests. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Hezbollah Secretary General Sayed Hassan Nasrallah has highlighted the stance of the resistance front in addition to the significant achievements accomplished in the past 40 years.
One of our duties in the future is to strengthen the strategies of deterrence to protect Lebanon's people, land, state, sovereignty and dignity, and natural resources and treasures.
The most pressing matter awaiting the resistance, he said, was the issue of maritime resources.
The main and current challenge that we're facing now and the few upcoming days is the issue of gas and petrol and the demarcation of the maritime borders. I will not say anything new. We have said everything that we should say. Now we're all waiting. The Israelis are talking and threatening, but we should wait and see.
The cause of Palestine was also a very significant endeavor, which Hezbollah sees as a duty of the past, present, and future.
In the last 40 years, we always believed in Palestine and the Palestinian resistance. We were dutifully supporting it, and we declared that openly and supported it in all forms, in the media and in politics. We have always declared that we stand by the side of the Palestinian people and the holy sites.
Celebrating 40 years since it was founded as a resistance movement, Hezbollah organized a mass rally where artists used hologram technology to commemorate the movement's martyred leaders. Those attending stressed that if it weren't for the resistance, they would not be here today.
The passion they had, the religious that it was in their heart, that made them believe that they can take care of us, of our lands, of our everything. Without them, we are nothing.
The celebration included real footage of past operations during the Israeli occupation of Lebanon, the liberation of most Lebanese land in May of 2000, as well as significant images from the 2006 summer confrontation of the Israeli assaults, and finally the fight against Takfiri terrorists in the eastern border mountains.
Hezbollah says it's celebrating more than a mere date on the calendar as its establishment day. 40 years ago today, the Israeli army, backed by multinational forces, occupied the capital, Beirut. But here, a group of young men believed liberation was possible and achieved the unthinkable. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
The British government is facing calls to press for the freedom of a young woman imprisoned in Saudi Arabia over her use of Twitter. Salma Al-Shahab, the 34-year-old mother of two, is a Saudi national who lived and studied in Britain before her arrest whilst visiting family inside Saudi Arabia in January 2021. Salma's original sentence was just 3 years, but earlier this month an appeals court extended her term, sentencing her to 34 years in prison, followed by a 34-year travel ban.
What's Salma's crime, you may ask? Just a series of Twitter posts and retweets, all of content critical of the Saudi regime. Her sentence is thought to be one of the longest ever doled out by the Saudi authorities against a female human rights activist inside the kingdom.
Activists and lawyers consider her lengthy jail sentence as shocking and outrageous, even by Saudi standards of justice. An opposition Labour MP, Hilary Benn, confirmed via a Twitter post he has sent a letter to Foreign Secretary and Tory leadership hopeful Liz Truss, demanding her intervention to help free the jailed student. As earlier this year, Truss declined to criticise the kingdom for its poor human rights record, saying Riyadh is an important partner of the UK. Critics expressed concern over not only Saudi rights abuses, but Western countries' double standards too.
I don't think the UK has that much influence at all if Liz Truss is going to try her hand. Of course, what we are seeing is the usual Western double standards. Only a few days before this horrific prison sentence was issued, Joe Biden was standing up for Salman Rushdie and saying that he had a right to free speech, and this was very much part of American values. But obviously those American values don't extend to Salma Al-Shahab.
Ever since Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman became Saudi Arabia's de facto leader in 2017, the kingdom has become even more intolerant of any internal criticism and activism, jailing activists, bloggers, intellectuals, and others for their political activism. International condemnation has done little to stop Saudi's behaviour, including the brutal killing of dissident journalist Jamal Khashoggi in Istanbul in 2018. Robert Carter, London.
Iran's foreign minister's trip to Mali has come to an end. Amir Abdullahian and his Malian counterpart, Abdullah Diop, hailed their meeting as constructive, hoping that their negotiations would help develop bonds of friendship between the two nations.
We made an agreement with Mali's foreign minister and the head of the country's transitional government to take big steps in the coming months in various areas, including the activities of knowledge-based companies and transfer of technology in this field, as well as defense cooperation to help boost peace, stability, and security in this country.
Both sides are more dedicated than ever to taking the next steps to deepen ties.
The trip to Mali marked Amir Abdullahian's first visit to an African nation during his time in office as Iran's foreign minister. He then departed Bamako for his next destination, Dar es Salaam, Tanzania's largest city, an industrial hub which is home to the country's main port. Upon arrival at Dar es Salaam's international airport, Tanzanian Foreign Minister Liberata Mulamula warmly welcomed his Iranian counterpart.
We are delighted to have this high-level visit. And while he's here, I know His Excellency has only a few days, but we'd like him to see Tanzania and be able to visit Zanzibar and visit the capital. So we are really excited. We are also excited that he's coming with the business group. So we'll have a business forum. So we want also to thank the ambassador here for organizing this. So to you all, we say karibu sana.
Amir Abdullahian, for his part, thanked his counterpart for hosting the top diplomat and his accompanying delegation, as well as governmental and private sector representatives.
There are lots of opportunities for developing Iran-Tanzania relations, particularly in the fields of mining and energy. Iran's top diplomat will take part in a business forum and also visit the country's top officials to explore potential for boosting bilateral cooperation. Mahdi Abbasian, Dar es Salaam.
This is IRIB English Radio. Website is www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
They are counting on that small investment in anti-tax Republicans to save them billions in taxes, said Americans for Tax Fairness, which conducted the analysis. Stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Kenny Stencil, journalist. This article is published under the heading, Just 27 Billionaires Have Spent $90 Million to Buy GOP Congress, a report shows. Here's the story. A few dozen billionaires are spending tens of millions of dollars on the 2022 midterm elections, mostly to support Republican candidates, including many who have parroted the dangerous lie that the 2020 presidential election was stolen, in a bid to ensure that Congress is full of lawmakers willing to make their wealthy benefactors even richer, according to a fresh analysis. Titled Billionaires Buying Elections, the report from Americans for Tax Fairness, ATF, details how billionaires are increasingly using their personal fortunes and the profits of connected corporations to drown out regular voters' voices and elect hand-picked candidates who further rig the nation's economy, especially the tax system. A pair of super PACs tasked with securing Republican majorities in the House and Senate, the Congressional Leadership Fund, CLF, and the Senate Leadership Fund, SLF, raised a combined $188.3 million through the first 16 months of the 2022 campaign cycle, according to ATF. Nearly half, $89.4 million, or 48%, came from just 27 billionaires. A whopping 86% of the GOP's billionaire money came from Wall Street tycoons, who are arguably the biggest beneficiaries of glaring loopholes in the tax code. The Democratic counterparts of those two super PACs, the House Majority PAC and the Senate Majority PAC, raised a combined $154 million over the same time period. Smaller share, $25.8 million, or 17%, came from 19 billionaires. A majority of billionaire contributions to Democratic candidates also came from the finance and investment sector, about 35%, but other industries were also well represented, including cryptocurrency, 26%, and tech, 18%. Unlike candidates and party committees, super PACs can raise unlimited donations from individuals and corporations, ATF explained. In return, they are not supposed to coordinate activities with the campaigns they support, but instead act independently, though that rule is often flouted. Top billionaire donors to congressional super PACs include hedge fund magnate Ken Griffin, who has given more than $28.5 million to CLF and SLF, and private equity mogul Stephen Schwarzman, who has pumped $20 million into GOP's super PACs. Anti-democratic vote-buying, ATF wrote, has been facilitated by and is facilitating the accelerating wealth growth of the billionaire class and the record profits of the corporations they won. The combined net worth of the nation's roughly 750 billionaires surged by $2 trillion, or 70%, during the first 2 years of the COVID-19 pandemic. The collective wealth of the 27 billionaires bankrolling the GOP super PACs alone soared by $82.4 billion over that time period, meaning that the $89.4 million they have donated to CLF and SLF constitutes less than 0.1% of their overall pandemic-era gains. Meanwhile, the return on that modest investment could amount to billions of dollars if Republicans take back Congress in November and preserve their 2017 tax cuts or further slash taxes on super-rich people and the corporations they won. Over a recent nine-year period, the 400 wealthiest people in the U.S. paid an average effective federal income tax rate of just 8.2% when the increased value of their stock holdings is included in their income. That is a lower rate than the nationwide average of 13.3% in 2019. As ATF explained, focusing on contributions to congressional super PACs fails to capture the full political influence of billionaires who, in addition to personal donations, also steer money to favored candidates from related corporations and organizations. Billionaires are among the ultra-wealthy Americans who control corporations through their extensive stock holdings. Many corporate giants have been distorting the upcoming midterms, ATF pointed out, by spending tens of millions to help GOP candidates who have vowed to defend the special tax breaks for the top 1% get elected, including 144 far-right members of Congress who voted to overturn President Biden's electoral victory. According to the report, seven powerful corporations, including AT&T, Chevron, ExxonMobil, FedEx, GM, Merck, and Ops, have collectively given nearly $1.5 million to dozens of election deniers and various Republican PACs and election committees this campaign cycle. The companies demonstrated lack of concern for democracy, ATF noted, likely stems from their desire to keep dodging taxes. In 2021, these firms paid an average federal income tax rate of just 2.7% on a combined $78.4 billion in profits. Notably, Peter Thiel, the co-founder of PayPal, who is worth about $5 billion and openly opposed to democracy, has been spending big on his preferred Republican candidates, but not through the GOP's congressional super PACs. Thiel has so far spent almost $30 million through super PACs, supporting the 2022 senatorial bids of two firms, and employees who share his anti-democratic and anti-tax beliefs, ATF found, adding, J.D. Vance won the Ohio Republican U.S. Senate primary thanks in part to Thiel's $15 million in spending. Blake Masters has a fighting chance in Arizona's GOP U.S. Senate primary in August due to Thiel's $13.5 million in contributions. Another source of billionaire dominance of campaign financing, especially on the Republican side, wrote ATF, are so-called dark money groups, which are not required to disclose the identity of their donors. Some dark money groups, including Club for Growth, which has received $32 million from billionaire Wall Street trader Jeffrey Yes over the years, are notorious for having bankrolled insurrectionist members of Congress like Senator Josh Hawley and Lauren Boebert, ATF noted. According to the report, politically active billionaire Charles Koch has personally donated to either GOP Super PAC this cycle, but his corporation Koch Industries has so far given them a total of $1.75 million. Two of the biggest dark money groups, which do not disclose their donors, are essentially sister groups to the two congressional GOP super PACs. American Action Network gave at least $26 million to CLF in the 2020 cycle and $18.7 million so far this cycle. One Nation donated $77.5 million to SLF last cycle and has given $16.5 million so far this cycle. The ability of the nation's wealthiest individuals to translate their disproportionate economic power into political clout has increased exponentially since the U.S. Supreme Court's 2010 Citizens United decision eliminated effective limits on campaign contributions. According to the report, billionaires pumped $1.2 billion into the 2020 elections, almost 40 times more than the $31 million they donated in 2010, when the Citizens United rules were first in effect. In the 2020 election cycle, billionaires contributed nearly $1 out of every $10, while making up just 0.1% of all donors contributing more than $200. Billionaires donated almost $240 million to the combined campaign efforts of Donald Trump's two runs for president. Over half came from just one billionaire household, that of magnate Sheldon Adelson, who has since died. Billionaires who are used to buying whatever they want have increasingly dedicated their almost unlimited resources to buying American elections, Frank Clement, executive director of ATF, said in a statement. The problem is what's good for billionaires, including cutting taxes on the rich and corporations, is bad for working families, said Clement. We need to rein in billionaire political and economic power through campaign finance reforms and tax reforms, such as a billionaire's income tax. Several legislative proposals have emerged to tax the increased value of assets owned by the nation's wealthiest households each year, regardless of whether they sell or keep them, which would ensure that income derived from wealth is taxed more like income earned from work. Biden's plan would raise an estimated $360 billion over 10 years, while Senator Ron Wyden's plan would raise an estimated $550 billion over a decade, and Representative Jamal Bowman's proposal possibly even more. Billionaire-backed Democratic Senator Joe Manchin, however, has joined Senate Republicans in opposing such a measure.
Stories from the past. Stories from the lives of the infallibles. Stories from different parts of the world. On the Lantern.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah, the Most Compassionate, the Most Merciful, dear brothers and sisters, Salaam alaikum, welcome to this episode of Lantern. Now, on the continuation of this program, Lantern, we have a nice story. Let's listen to it. Aun and Muhammad is the title of today's story. Aun and Muhammad were the sons of Lady Zainab. They had not accompanied Lady Zainab when she left Medina with Imam al-Hussein, peace be upon him. Just before Imam Hussein started his journey from Mecca, Hazrat Abdullah ibn Ja'far brought his two sons to Mecca and handing them over to Imam al-Hussein said, "Ya Imam, since you have decided to go and will not allow me to come with you, please take my two sons with you. Aun will represent his maternal grandfather, Hazrat Ali, and the other will represent his paternal grandfather, Hazrat Ja'far Tayyar." Aun and Muhammad were quite young. It is reported that Aoun was about 13 and Muhammad was a year or two younger. They had learned the art of fencing from his uncle, Hazrat Abbas. On the night before Ashura, Lady Zainab said to them, "My sons, tomorrow there will be a battle. I cannot ask you to fight because you are young. But if anything happens to Imam al-Hussein, while you are still alive, I will be filled with shame." Both the boys stood up and said, "Mother, we have the blood of Ali and Jafar in our veins. Our grandfathers were warriors whose fame will always be remembered. Do you think we can possibly shame them? Moreover, we are the pupils of Uncle Abbas. Mother, unless you forbid us and stop us from fighting, we shall go to the battlefield and show the enemies of Islam how bravely the children of Islam can fight. All we want from you is a promise that you will never weep for us. Our souls will never rest in peace if you grieve for us after we are gone." Tears of joy and pride flowed down Lady Zainab's eyes as she embraced her two boys in the day of Ashura. The two boys rode out into the battlefield. They fought bravely. At one point, Omar Sad asked, "Who are those two youngsters? They fight like I have seen Ali ibn Abu Talib fight." When he was told who they were, he ordered his soldiers to give up single combats and surround and kill the boys. Aoun and Muhammad were attacked from all sides. Soon they were overpowered and brutally killed. Imam Hussein and Hazrat Abbas carried the two young bodies to a tent and laid them on the floor. Imam walked to Lady Zainab's tent. He found her in sajda praying, "Ya Allah, I thank you for accepting my sacrifice. My heart is filled with pride because my two sons have given their lives for your religion."
Dr. Fakhr Rohani.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim wa bi nasta'in. In this episode, we're going to be concerned with Aoun and Muhammad, who were two children of Hazrat Zainab, salamullah alayha. Aoun ibn Abdullah and Muhammad ibn Abdullah, both of them were among the Ashura martyrs. In some cases, someone else by the name of Ubaidullah or Abdullah. It's also mentioned among the children of Hazrat Zainab, salamullah alayha, who were martyred on the plain of Karbala. One of the important aspects of the ziyarat text in favor of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam is that in the book Al-Mazar al-Kabir of Ibn Mashhadi, there is a ziyarat text in favor of the Ashura martyrs. This ziyarat text reached Sheikh Muhammad ibn Ghalib Isfahani in the year 252. And it's indicated that it was issued by Nahiyya Muqaddasa. At that time, Nahiyya Muqaddasa was a title that referred to Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam or Imam al-Askari, and finally Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam. According to a piece of research done by the late Sheikh Muhammad Mahdi Shamsuddin of Lebanon, this ziyarat text, Nahiyya Muqaddasa, if correct, it must be issued by Imam al-Askari alayhi salam, or it must be dictated by Imam al-Askari alayhi salam. And the text of the ziyarat text, phrasing is in such a way: "Assalamu ala Aoun ibn Abdullah ibn Ja'far al-Tayyar fil-Janan, Halif al-Iman wa Manazil al-Aqran, al-Nasih lil-Rahman, al-Tali lil-Mathani, wal-Qur'an la'anallahu qatilahu, Abdullah ibn Qutbah al-Nabhani." And in the case of Muhammad ibn Abdullah, it's indicated in this way: "Assalamu ala Muhammad ibn Abdullah ibn Ja'far, الشاهد مكان أبيه وتالي لأخيه وواقيه ببدنه لعن الله قاتله أمر ابن نحشل التيمي."
the lantern.
Under the light of lantern, we'll look at the story, which indicates a moral aspects of our life.
In this connection, it must be indicated in the special ziyarat text in favor of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, to be recited on the first day of Rajab and on the half of Sha'ban, 15th of Sha'ban, and in other books, such as in Al-Iqbal and Al-Mazar, the names of On and Muhammad are indicated in the ziyarat text, in which the names of Ashur and Martyrs are indicated. In this connection, it must be indicated that according to a great majority of maqtaz, that is martyrdom narratives, Abdullah ibn Ja'far and Aun ibn Abdullah, and then Muhammad ibn Abdullah and Ubaydullah ibn Abdullah ibn Ja'far are mentioned to have been martyred in Ashura in Karbala. However, in some other books, in some other texts, like Tabaqat al-Kubra, al-Ma'arif, Maqatil al-Talibin of Ibn Shahr Ashur, Maqatil al-Talibin of Abu al-Faraj al-Isfahani, and Sab al-Ashraf of al-Baladri, Nafasul Mahmu of Sheikh Abbas Qumi, there's another martyr who is called Aun al-Akbar, I mean Aun the Elder, among the martyred sons of Imam of Hazrat Zainab salamullah alayha. Regarding Abdullah ibn Ja'far, who was martyred on Ashura, Muhammad ibn Abdullah, I mean, his name is sometimes given as Muhammad ibn Abdullah, sometimes Abdullah ibn Ja'far. In this connection, we find that there were, I mean, these, I mean, martyrs have been indicated. I mean, their names have been indicated in such books. In a great majority of sources, the mother of Muhammad ibn Abdullah ibn Ja'far is introduced as Khawsa bint Hafsa, was another wife of Abdullah ibn Ja'far. In this connection, it must be indicated that in Maqatil al-Talibin of Abu al-Faraj al-Isfahani, Ubaydullah ibn Abdullah is another son of Abdullah ibn Ja'far, whose mother is mentioned as Khawsa bint Hafsa. Thank you.
That was all for today. Thank you very much for joining us. Inshallah, we continue this topic on the next episode. Till then, may Allah bless all of you. Fi amanillah. Ala bi dhikrillah
tatma'innul qulub. Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.